Our next speaker is Kathy Kelly, well-known activist and witness of crimes in the Middle East, founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who's going to be speaking about the impact of the death and destruction the U.S. government is continuing to bring to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, thank you, Neil and Betty, and the Chicago Coalition Against War. And thank you, Ali. I hope that your family will be safe, and I hope you'll feel welcome here in Chicago. Thank you to all of you for coming this afternoon. I'm somebody who has been in quite a few war zones, in Nicaragua, in Bosnia, in the West Bank, in Gaza, in Iraq and in Afghanistan and Lebanon. And so I'm very easily persuaded that war is never the answer. But something I learned in Iraq was that after having been there in 1991, during the war that followed on the heels of the Iran-Iraq war, and you know, Henry Kissinger had said at that point, things couldn't be better. They're killing each other and using our weapons to do it. And then there ensued the United States' first Gulf War against Iraq. And we were there in a desert encampment, and my upward learning curve about Iraq went up pretty fast. Upon return, it seemed as though, certainly Iraq had gone off the headlines, wasn't even being thought of about in the United States. But we began to realize far too late that the economic war was actually far more brutal, and this is what Ali's relatives in Iran are no doubt experiencing, far more punitive, far more lethal against the most innocent of people, the elderly, the sick, the poor, and then at a rate of astonishing horror, the children. You can never expect children to be accountable for their government. You can never rightfully punish children. And they were dying first in the hundreds and then in the thousands, and then the United Nations said hundreds of thousands. And may I just recall with you being in a Baghdad hospital with one of the finest pediatricians in the world, Dr. Hussain Rahim. And he tried his best, and there were no lights, you know, there's no electricity, no parts, no incubators. And they were calling for him, screaming up and down a hallway, because these were modern big hospitals, but of course, now they just had to scream to get the doctor's attention. And he went running, because, of course, the elevators don't work. And he got to the bedside of a little girl who had a very bad respiratory infection, but that combined with near starvation was what killed her. And she needed oxygen. She needed to be given assistance in breathing. And Dr. Kasai examined her, and then he stood up, and he said to the mother, "I am sorry. Your child, she cannot live. We have not the oxygen. We have not the tube." And you see, the plastic tube they did have was the size of a pencil. But this little girl, Zahra's nostril, was the size of the point of the pencil. And there was a big oxygen tube there. But for want of a piece of plastic, that little girl died the tormenting death. And I remember the mother, she pulled me down next to her. My shoulder was damp from her tears. And she said, "Believe me, I pray that this never happens to a woman from your country." And so the killing went on. I was with a young nurse, Martin Thomas, from the UK, in a similar hospital ward. And he looked around and he said, "I think I understand. It's a death row for infants, isn't it? A death row for infants." And people came up to me. I was living in Baghdad in 2003 in advance of the shock and awe bombing and stayed there throughout that bombing. And men whom I'd regarded as people with nerves of steel would come up to me and say, just because they needed to say it, "Believe me, Kathy, I am so scared." Or, how it can be that I can protect my children. And I actually thought, they'll never do it. You know, Ali mentioned this big, huge demonstration, and I thought, no. And I know that all many of you were in the streets of Chicago and you were organizing, and there was that kind of solid sense. And the world came closer than ever before to stopping a war before it started. And I think we learned something from the Arab Spring. If we're ever in that situation again, sit down and don't get up. Not on Monday, not on Tuesday. But that war went forward. Well, now Iraq is a broken, battered country. I'm not even sure you can call it a country. You know, the Kurds are understandably organizing to try to meet their needs and separate from the rest of the country. The west of the country, where the Sunni bases were, is pretty battered and worn down, and you've got kind of a rump south that's very much linked up with Iran. Why did the United States do it? I think it's what Neil has stated to us, that the United States has said, I mean, I heard it as a senior in college from Noam Chomsky, that the foreign policy of the U.S. essentially based on threatened force and killing is that if you do not, said to every other country in the world, if you do not subordinate yourselves to fulfill our national interests, we will eliminate you. And witness Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm lucky to go over to Afghanistan and be the guest of some of the most idealistic, attractive young people imaginable, the Afghan peace volunteers. And I've been there about 35 times. I'll go again in September. And, you know, they see the United States as one among many warlords, obviously the wealthiest, the one with the most frightening, intimidating arsenal, but one among many warlords. And there was something very instructive, if I can just draw your attention to the terrible killing in Kabul on Monday of the past week. The Taliban took credit, and there were at least 21 school children hospitalized. It was a massive car bombing. Another just happened in the province of Ghazni yesterday, and these bombs are being used so ferociously and viciously while the peace talks are supposedly inching toward some kind of a conclusion in Qatar. But it seems like the idea is, well, you know, the more we can gain leverage at the peace talks by war on the ground, by killing people and showing off our weapons, the better off we'll be at the conclusion. Call it barbarous. It's hideous, and it is wrongful. But I think there's a sort of a terrible morality tale in that particular bombing, because the car bomb not only affected a government facility and the Jamshad television station, but also a museum, a private war museum. And I've been to this museum several times. And it's a museum that, by our standards, is kind of primitive, I suppose, but it contains encasements of munitions, landmines, various weapons that have been used in the history of Iraq, particularly over the last four decades. And every exhibit also has the name of the country that manufactured the bomb or the landmine and the explosive power of the landmine. Well, it's a bit curious, and I didn't reflect on it until reading the New York Times this past week, but the only exhibit showing United States munitions is one small case about 3 feet by 3 feet, inside of which is the hideous and ugly cluster bomb. And a cluster bomb contains 200 bomblets. Every single cluster bomb contains 200 more bombs, and they fly in many different directions, and they look like building blocks, like little yellow playthings, and a child who's curious could very easily pick one up if they find one long after it's landed on the ground, as has happened again and again and again, affecting 30,000 people in Afghanistan, many of them children. The United States dropped 1,228 cluster bombs on just the first days of the war against Afghanistan. And it has strewn munitions all across that country. And the reason why the museum, the private war museum, only showed one exhibit reflecting United States munitions was because it turns out the United States has subsidized that museum for $400 million. Well, it's better the museum is there than not there, but children go to that museum, their teachers bring them there, and they don't learn about the history of how the United States has beaten and battered their own country. Now, in fact, they do know, and my young friends have been so idealistic. They go up the mountains, they find where are the poorest of people, and in those homes they sit down and they talk and they listen. They do their surveillance, and it's good surveillance. Meanwhile, the United States is spending billions of dollars constantly scouring the territory, reading miles of footage that the drones pick up, and trying to figure out, oh, where's the next high-value target? People from the Paktia province have told us that they're running out of spaces to bury the dead. The bombing is so constant. And I just want to take us back in history a little bit to when the Obama administration said it was engaging in the largest retrograde mission in military history. Retrograde means bringing the troops back. The cost to keep one soldier in Afghanistan at that point was $2 million per year for one soldier. $2 million per year for one U.S. soldier in Afghanistan if you spread out all the costs of this largest retrograde mission. That same year, the cost to put iodized salt in the diet of a child who was starving, the iodized salt that could help that child survive without brain deficiency, the cost to do that would have been 5 cents per child per year. May we look at the scales of justice. Think of your family, your friends, your neighbors. Who would choose the $2 million to maintain the soldier and to keep Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and Boeing and Raytheon and General Dynamics and all the weapon makers and all the warlords stocked, running to the bank, their portfolios stuffed, their greed unchecked? Who would choose the war making over saving the child? When I went to Iraq, we knew the war was coming, I suppose. I still harbored hopes. But sometimes we didn't quite know, well, where should we go, what should we do while we were there waiting. And so we started to go to the university, to the place where within the university people spoke English because that was what they were studying. And so I went quite often to a university and got to know English literature graduate students, Iraqi young women studying English literature, and it turned out that four of them were working on their doctoral dissertation on the poetry of Wilfred Owen. Under a dictatorship, studying Wilfred Owen's poetry? Wilfred Owen, the pacifist poet who died in the trenches of World War I? Wilfred Owen, who likened Europe promoting that war to Father Abraham from the poem, "The Angel of the Lord said, lay not thy hand upon the lad. See in the thicket a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not so, and slew the son, and half the seed of Europe one by one." We sat there with tears in our eyes discussing exactly that passage. For those of you who are English lit buffs, it turns out Siegfried Sassoon was born in Baghdad, so that might have been the connection. But what I most want to emphasize is, how do we offer the ram of pride instead? What do we need to offer up? Any belief that we automatically have a right to a bigger piece of the pie than other people around the world, that we automatically have a right to determine the leadership or the distribution of resources in any other country. It's not our right. It won't ever help to bring about a better world. Thank you.